Okay, so today I'm in Somerset with Tom Malone. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Tom. You're a bloodstock agent. You've purchased over 3,000 winners, including the winner of the Grand National, one for Arthur, the Gold Cup, Native River, and the Royal Ascot Prince of Wales Stakes, My Dreamboat. Which purchase of any, not just those three, has given you the most satisfaction?
I'd say Native River is probably the one that's given more satisfaction, because he was the first real big star, you know. He'd done things that most horses can't do. He was really tough. He won a Hennessy and a Welsh National in the same season, which has never been done before. And he ran in Cheltenham, four or five consecutive years, and he was in the Gold Cup and he won it. He was a hard horse, he was. He was a really hard horse to pass. And he won £1 million in prize money. Not many horses do that ever. You know, only the greats get to do that.
Okay, now before we go into your current breeding operation, can you tell us a little bit where it all began? I mean, are you from like a horse racing family?
No, absolutely not. I never seen a horse till I was 14. I grew up in a housing estate, and two girlfriends on my 14th birthday, which was a Saturday, decided that they were going for a riding lesson and wanted to take me as a birthday present. I had no interest. And after a bit of badgering for half an hour, they said, come on, you must come. So I decided, yeah, all right, go on, let's go. And I got bit by the bug the first time I rode a horse.
What sort of horses were they?
I were only ponies, only hunting horses. I went over, I'll never forget it, Stan. Little Stan he was, a little cracker he was. And after going for three or four lessons, weekends on the trot, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks later, I was working there full time. I used to work there every weekend. Every minute I could spend there hunting and show jumping. I loved it. It was an amazing time. With a family about 7 miles from me in a place called Clara in County Offaly. They were like mum and dad to me, second mum and dad. They looked after me very, very well.
Okay, now I've got all your facts and figures from your UK riding career, but so yeah. Where are you riding in Ireland?
I done a bit throughout. I was pony race champion in Ireland. It was my first dig into racing. So after hunting, I spent 14 to maybe 16, 17 hunting and doing whatnot, and then I decided we needed to go racing. And then I worked for Tom Lacey, and I spent about a year and a half with him. And then I went to J.A. Quinn, where I was able to get a license. As an amateur, I had a ride for him in a bumper. It wasn't much, but it was nice to get a ride. And then we went to Philip Rothwell's. And before I went to Philip Rothwell's, we went greyhound racing one night, and I met up with Ronnie Began. And Ronnie Began said a very, very interesting piece of information to me. If you're going to shovel shit, shovel it for the best. If you're going to ride, ride for the best. And that stuck with me throughout my career from start to finish now. So then I rang Philip Rothwell, and I went to Philip Rothwell as a conditional, and I got my first ever winner in a little horse called Little Aura in Downpatrick. I had about 100 rides for him. It was lovely. It was a great experience. But I needed to go to England, because unless you were Barry Geraghty or Paul Carberry or Ruby Walsh, you weren't going to make it in Ireland, and I was far from one of them. So I rang Mr. Hobbs, because he'd said, look, Ronnie Began had said, look up who gives their kids the best chances, their conditionals, amateurs, and it was Philip Hobbs. So I rang up and he said, I've no job for you as a conditional, but I have one as an amateur. So I was an amateur, then turned conditional, and then I turned back amateur to come over to England. And I wasn't here 2 or 3 weeks, and I had my first winner, and I had 5 rides from him, 3 winners. And Dave Roberts took me on. He was my agent to start with, but sure, I got a horrible fall on the gallops one morning, dislocated my shoulder, and I was out for nearly 3 months with that. And once I got back, I was back a week, and I broke my ankle in a fall of Fontwell. So the first 6 months of England was amazing. The second 6 was a disaster. So when I came back, then Philip said that Robert Stevens had taken over as amateur. So it was time, I could stay there and work, but that there'd be very few opportunities for me. And I said, nah, I deserve a bit better than that. So I decided to go home, but I packed up the Fiesta and I went to Fishguard after booking the boat. And I'd say I cried for 2 hours. I was going home a failure. England was after chewing me up and spitting me out. And I was going home after 1 year of failure, and I hated that feeling. That just did not sit well with me. So I took out my horses and trainer book, and this is the phone call that changed my life. I rang Martin Pipe himself. And I asked him, could I have a job? And he said, there'll be no rides, but you can come and work. And if you work hard, maybe down the road something might change, but there'll be no rides. Grand, so what have I to lose? So I went home for a week, came back, and never looked back. I had my first ride from after 3 weeks.
Right, so you, then hopefully I've got my figures right here. Your best season was 2004-2005, 30 winners from 203 rides. So it's a 15% strike rate. For anybody that bets, which is most of the watchers here, £65 profit to a pound stake.
Yeah, one of them was a 50-to-1 shot.
Well, that, okay. That helped. And you've won nearly a quarter of a million quid in prize money. So at that point, was your ambition looking forward to be a top jockey?
No. I knew my limitations. I can ride a horse, of course I can ride a horse, but to be elitist and to be the best, you got to have that flair about you, and I just didn't have it. I enjoyed it. I had some great days, and because of Martin Pipe and Pond House, I had some brilliant days. Got to ride in the Grand National, had winners round Cheltenham, got beat a half a length in the County Hurdle at the Cheltenham Festival. Probably should have won. when I think back about the good rides I got, and it was down to Pond House, I wouldn't have got them anywhere else.
Okay, now I was going to say, was it especially frustrating that you were watching the top jockeys at the yards you were in, but maybe it wasn't then?
It definitely was, because I'm competitive. By nature, I'm very, very competitive, but I knew my limitations as a jockey, and I'm also clever enough to know that you can be competitive, but you have to know where your ability lies. And I still wanted to get on them, there's no doubt about that, and I always thought, oh, I should be getting more, but maybe looking back, I got what I deserved and as much as I deserved. But when you're inside the bubble, it's very hard to explain to people that haven't been in that position. When you're inside the bubble of being a jockey, nothing matters outside. You can't see outside, nothing cares. Eat, sleep, and race them. We just up in the morning, ride as many lots, go race and bang, bang, let's get on a horse, let's get on a horse. Sometimes you're going racing and losing money. You didn't care. That's not what you were doing it for. Money will follow if you're successful and whatnot, but it's not till you get outside the bubble and you look back and think, how the hell did I ever do that? And so I had a great time. I met some brilliant people and worked for some brilliant people that molded me to where I am now, if you know what I mean, the way they conducted themselves and the way I needed to. And that had a big outcome in my life.
Now you rode a career total in the UK anyway of 70 winners. Must have been, were you employed by the yard and was the riding the cherry on the top? Or
yeah, I was employed by the yard as well. So I had a wage. I had a wage from the yard, which stabilised everything. You could still run your family. And but when you think about it, 70 winners. Harry Cobden's on 100 winners this season so far. Lads ride 70 winners in 6 months now, you know. So I don't ever class it as a big achievement, really. I'm delighted I've done it and I'll never take it away. And something that, you know, I got to ride in the Grand National twice and I got round twice. And
well, tell us about that, because you had the full house of completing the course.
Yeah, I had two rides and two completes and I was brilliant. I rode Polar Red. I think he won the Imperial Cup for Stan Clark and Martin Pike and ended up over fences. Then I got to ride him in the National. It was the year Hedgehunter won. And sure, he dropped in last or round about the back of the field and just hunted away. He made one mistake in 4.5 miles, the first fence. He nodded. I thought, oh, he's going down. He never did. And then he was like an absolute bunny rabbit after that. But as we went down the side of the course the second time, we're getting to after Beechers, got to the canal turn. I said, aye, aye, this horse started to take the bridle. When horses were going that way, he started to go that way. And down across the next fine are all them fences down along the side of the course before he turned for home. I arrived upsides on a 250-to-1 shot, Polar Red, beside Hedgehunter. There was five of us in a line, and here I am up on the outside. But he didn't yet. He never got the trip. I think he finished about 13th in the end. And the next time I got to ride, I was riding a horse called Melanda Mill. And we used to drop him in all the time. But I knew it was my last year riding. And he was such an amazing jumper. I thought, nah, if we're going out, we're going out in a blaze of glory. So I jumped off and made it. And for the first circuit, I was about five clear, jumping fences, and it was lovely to watch the car and the camera coming, and he was going down. I was loving, this horse was letting fly at fences, but he was so accurate, and he jumped the chair in front the first time.
The sounds where you're talking that it was an enjoyable experience.
It was an amazing experience. The first time you do it, you don't know. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth. You just don't know what to expect, do you? Yeah. But I could enjoy it a bit more the second time because I kind of knew what was coming. But you're on a good jumper. It's normally staying out of trouble. That was a very, very good thing to do.
And you rode five Cheltenham winners. Were they for Pipey?
Yeah, no, they were for everyone, really. And they weren't at the festival, but I rode three for Mr. Pipe and two for other people. I can't remember who they were, but yeah, some good fun there.
Yeah, so during that time, I mean, from the 2008 to 2011, you only had 14 rides, so you're obviously winding it right down.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
During that, were you honing your skills at spotting potential in horses? I mean, where were you?
In 2007-08, I started buying a few horses, and one horse that got me going, the first horse I ever bought was Milton the BF, and I bought him out of Ireland after he was handicapped as a four or five-year-old in Ireland. And then he went for a summer's grass. He came back in, he won a maiden point of point, and then he won a winner's one. And when my mate rang me up to see if there was anyone in England that could buy this horse, I looked him up. He had a handicap mark of 82. And I went, he's chucked in. I mean, I had him kind of in my head 105, maybe even 110. And I said, grand. So I bumped into Nick Schutz at Utoxeter and I asked him to buy the horse. He rang me the next day and said, yeah. And I said, I wouldn't charge him any money for it, but I had to ride the horse. And I had three winners on him. I rode his first three runs, I won on him. And I thought, so that's where it started to roll. And I just kept my head down and kept rolling, going from sale to sale and making horrendous mistakes, but learning from them very quickly. It's been an enjoyable journey so far.
So for someone that says you didn't, you know, sort of get involved with horses at all till about 14,
yeah.
Did you sort of have anybody that sort of taught
no,
you anything?
No.
Just literally a natural?
No, well, I won't say natural. I would say because it wasn't natural at the start because I got so many things wrong. But I'm adamant. The one thing I've always been good at is I very rarely make a second mistake. I don't like it. It doesn't sit well with me. I hate the feeling of it. So I learn quickly. I wouldn't be very clever, but I class myself as having a lot of common sense. There's two different types of people there. I'm around a lot of very clever people, and sometimes I think to myself, you've got no common sense, and that's how clever. So I would class myself as having some common sense as such, more so than being very brainy.
Okay, so you hit the ground running with Milton BF.
Yeah.
Is that the moment you decided to go into bloodstock full-time?
Or it wasn't even full-time, but I was commentating on Pint of Pints. I remember being at Exeter one day as an amateur, and the commentator never turned up. And there was no commentary throughout the world for the first race. And no one knew why. And then there was a Tannoy message from the stewards asking if anyone in the crowd had done pint-to-pint commentating. So I looked at the race card, seeing that the next race was a four-runner race. I thought, how bad? I'll go out. I'll say nothing. All the boys were in the tea room. I went out, told the stewards I'd done loads of it, which I hadn't. And there was stewards and everyone was around me. Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for helping us out. Up we go. Off I go. Do the four-runner race. And the lads, by all accounts, were wetting themselves in the tea room. So I was only doing it for a bit of tomfoolery. I love having a bit of a joke and a laugh. And I started commentating in the West Country, doing all the point-to-points. It got me going. I was working for At The Races as well. So albeit I was a jockey, I was doing plenty of other things because I knew it was only going to last for so long. And I love being busy. I love being busy. So I needed to find something that was going to pay the wages, keep my family going. And yeah, so once the bloodstock started to kick in, I thought, oh, this is a good job now. We can roll with this.
All right, Tom, you've already, obviously you're already doing what you're doing, but was there a moment when you realised that, I know you've been modest in the first part, but was there a moment you sort of realised that you had a talent either, you know, in this sphere for buying, selling, spotting a good one? Was it like a catalyst moment?
I don't think that's what kicked in at any stage to start with. I'd say I must have been doing it from 2008 to about 2013 or 14. Just head down, just getting it right, getting it wrong, getting it right. I'm not, as much as a lot of people who know me say I never shut up, I talk. I'm my biggest critic, I'm my own biggest critic, because I never, the one thing about this game is you can't pick yourself up too much because there's someone there to knock you straight away. And you can buy a good one, but you can buy a bad one next time. So where do you start and stop? But I just kept my head down, and of course I started buying a few horses. And I suppose the big kick was getting a horse into Paul Nichols. That probably changed it. I had to up the ante, and I had to be very good at what I do to be able to keep horses coming into his yard that deserve to be in there.
I mean, when you started, it's a big responsibility. Somebody's got to trust you. No offence, but you had 70 winners. You know, you've done some point-to-point commentary and stuff like that. And they've got to give you their money. They've got to trust you to spot a horse, because if you spot a bad one, they've done their money.
And I have done.
So how did you manage to persuade people early days?
I can talk to people. And I knew them. From being a jockey, I knew them. So I wasn't cold. It wasn't like they didn't know me at all. I worked for Pond House. I knew Paul Nichols. I knew Philip Hobbs. I had a bit of a grasp on it. And I loved buying cheap horses, because I grew up at Pond House, where cheap horse, win a race, get it done. Let's do it. And I used to keep buying them. And just by hook or by crook, we got it done. And they started to win races at a very modest level. But like, we started off, I think the first year I had 37 odd winners or something like that, and I was delighted with that. But we were getting up for 300 winners up on about 3 or 4 years ago. Do you know what I mean? And that's how big the business has gone. And I suppose my average spend on a horse from the start was about 14 grand. It's nearly 80 grand now. And I would buy 150 horses a year. So it's a massive business now. Do you know what I mean? And it's success that gets you there. But also, less mistakes. And that's what keeps it rolling. We're all going to buy bad horses. You can't get away from that. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but I tick boxes with horses. I have a certain criteria and a routine I go through. And over the 10 years, I've heightened it. It's squeezed it and got it to a point where when you're spending money at the top end, it's actually easier, because you can make better decisions. Because the potential is he's a good horse, right? They don't all be good horses, of course. But the middle market's the hardest, because you're expecting him to do better. Whereas at the top end, he's already there in the industry's eyes. So it's just getting to that point where you can buy him.
Okay, now you said that you saw 37 winnies in your first season.
Yeah.
I would imagine that's pretty good.
I was delighted, I thought it was brilliant.
You said you've learned from Mr. Pipe. He's getting cheap horses and getting to. So what sort of horses were you buying then?
Rubbish. Cheap horses that win races. But you could win races back then. The industry has changed so much that, you know, when I was at Pipes to start with, he used to be able to buy a horse and it'd win 3 or 4 novice hurdles, 2 handicaps. They've stopped you from doing that. You can't win more than 2 races with a horse now. And it's kind of defeated the purpose of buying a cheaper horse. There's still an avenue you can do it, but there's no prolific winners anymore, is there? Or very few. There's very few horses you see that has won 6 on the bounce anymore. Very few, because the industry is dead set against them doing it, which I think is a shame. I think we need winners. We need a horse to look like a horse and one that's capable of keeping winning without trying to stop them.
And back in those days, I mean, everybody knew that Martin Pipe was a better trainer than most other trainers, so you could buy a horse that had potential, send it to Mr. Pipe, and then you could expect. So when you were buying these ones, were you buying them for trainers that you knew had ability, or was it for owners that were going to have to send them to a good trainer?
Every horse I bought at the start was for the trainer. I didn't know an owner. I didn't know any owners. I mean, I knew David Johnson and whatnot, and actually my first ever Cheltenham Festival winner was for David Johnson and Andy Stewart, Salubrious. He won the Martin Pipe. Conditional jockeys race. He was the first good horse I bought, the first nice horse that was got to the next level, you know, capable of being a 140 horse. And yeah, that was a big achievement. And it was with someone who'd looked after me in the 10 years previous as a jockey. So that was a very special moment, being able to be a part of a winner with David Johnson and then Andy Stewart.
Now, you mentioned that you bought your first winner from an Irish pointer.
Yeah.
I mean, we hear a lot about horses being sourced from Irish point to point, have gone to be very top class. Do you spend a lot of time in Ireland looking for potential purchases now? Have you got spotters over there? Or?
98% of the time, I won't buy a horse without seeing it, because it's my eyes. And I can't tell an owner, you must buy this horse if I haven't seen it. I just can't. Or at least at worst, I have extremely great footage seen by someone I trust as well. I have two people that I use in France. I have one I use in Germany. But the Irish stuff, I have Jimmy Kelly. Jimmy Kelly in Ireland helps me out a lot when I can't get over quickly. He'll get in the car and go and see a horse if I really need it. But this week alone, I was in Ireland for 3 days. I've seen 240 pint of pointers that are ready to run in the next 3 months. By the end of my trips to Ireland, I will have seen 400 pint of pointers that will run over the next 6 months. So I've already have a picture. I have notes on every single one of them. So on the Sunday afternoon, the decks come through an hour before the race. Let's say there's 10 runners. I will have seen definitely 5 or 6 of them. I can size that race up. There's a maiden on Sunday here now. There's 34 entries. I've seen 23 of them. So of the 34 entries, I've already seen 23 of them. You know, so I already in my head know how that race is going to go.
So would you guys all get your cards marked? This is the potential superstar and you better see it, that sort of thing.
I don't think too many do it like I do. I don't want to think about if that horse is a good horse after he wins. I want to know before he wins. I want to know I've seen him. When I get rocking and rolling on a Sunday evening and spending large six-figure sums, I want to know this is the one. Because if you have to think about it, you will never be confident. I don't need to be. On Sunday afternoon, no one's more confident than I am. I'm getting it bought if it's the one I think it should be.
Okay, so why do, for us laymen, I mean, it's probably a simple question for you, but why do horses running in Irish point-to-points reach such huge figures compared to the UK counterparts?
Well, in the last 20 years, well, no, not even 20 years, probably 15, 10, 12, 15 years, the quality of animal running on a Sunday is far superior than the 30 years beforehand. You have between 30, 40 to 70, 80 grand stores running, and you have 7 or 8 of them running against each other. So you have 7 or 8 top quality animals taking each other on a Sunday, trained to perfection because it's a business. The chances are that's going to be the best horse. The industry in England is wrong. It shouldn't allow a 6-year-old near a 4-year-old. If you allow it, if a 6-year-old has ran 9 times, in the grand scheme of things, he might be moderate because he's still a maiden, but he's a handicapper. You're not teaching a 4-year-old to race. That 6-year-old, jump off, it'll go a gallop because it knows its job. The 4-year-old's trying to go with him. Now, if the 4-year-old doesn't beat him, getting 21 pounds off him, he's useless. But that's unfair. He shouldn't be running against him. The Irish, 4-year-olds run against 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds run against 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds run against 6-year-olds. In England, 4, 5, and 6-year-old maidens. Waste of time. Absolute waste of time. It's just... it's the wrong thing. Now, you have to do it at times. I done it last Sunday. I've done it, and it's worked out. But I don't think it's for the better of the industry. You don't have enough of the same quality of animal taking each other on the one Sunday, because you'll have 4 meetings on over here, and maybe they'll all avoid each other, and they'll all go off somewhere else. Whereas in Ireland, they can't really avoid it. They maybe can the odd time, but more often than not, they can't avoid each other.
Well, seeing the success that they've had in Ireland doing it that way, why do you think it is that the UK point-to-point people don't follow on?
You tell me. It should be fairly plain to see. The powers that be aren't willing to change it, or don't want to change it, or are being ignorant towards not changing it. It's very, very simple. If you have one 4-year-old maiden on a Sunday in England, they all have to run against each other, and then they can run a business from it. But don't, the thing about in England, why can't the English make as much money as the Irish? I stood in a field in Ireland one day. There was a 6-runner, 4-year-old maiden, and I was there to buy a horse called Danny Kerwin's brother. I bought Danny Kerwin, he was at Nichols, and I wanted to buy his brother. His trainer told me he's a good horse. I went there. The 6 of them turned out of the back straight, 2.5 mile maiden together. There was about 3 lengths, and 2 horses just took off as they turned for home at 2 to jump. Appreciate an on violin. So in a 6-runner race in Ireland, there was 2 Cheltenham Festival winners. One of them a multiple Cheltenham Festival winner. I can't name the last Cheltenham Festival winner that ran in an English point-to-point that's been trained in England still. Energonim was probably the last one I can remember. And he went to William Mullins. He's a champion chaser. But I can't remember enough of them, whereas it's happening 10, 15 times a year in Ireland.
Is it not a risky sort of business for vendors ever now? Horses sort of running around a field ridden by amateurs, you know, that could be worth 100 grand, or is it just got to be
done?
But
they're not ridden by amateurs, are they? Derek O'Connor's not an amateur, is he? Jamie Codd's not an amateur. Barry O'Neill's not an amateur. They're masquerading as amateurs. They're as good as any professional rider. And they're riding, the only things they ever ride are maidens. That's a scary thought, isn't it? Do you know, Barry O'Neill rode on violin that day. He's rode Sam Crowe, he's rode some of the best, so has Derek and Jamie. So they're not amateurs in as such, do you know what I mean? Mm. Whereas in England, it is run as an amateur sport. And maybe that's why they're reluctant to change it. Maybe they want to keep that amateur feel to it, which is fine. If that's what they want, that's great. But don't then get annoyed that the Irish are making all the money having a system for selling. It's run as a business in Ireland. It's run as an amateur sport in England.
Now, it's interesting. Hopefully, I've got my facts right here, because One for Arthur won its maiden on its fifth attempt.
Yeah.
Then after you purchased him, went on to win the Grand National in 2017. I mean, what did you see in him, assuming you didn't think, oh, there's the Grand National?
No, of course I didn't. But again, I ticked the boxes. He was by a good stallion, Milan. He'd shown consistent form. He'd been placed every run and got better with each run, and he won on his fifth start. He was coming from a trainer that they very rarely win first time out. So with all of that aside, and we had an order to fill that was, I don't know, we might have had 70 or 80 grand to spend on him, and he cost 60 grand. And it just ticked a lovely box. We were going to have a nice staying chaser. It's exactly what he turned out to be, a very good staying chaser, because he was very well handicapped and very well produced by Scoo and Lucinda, because he ended up that season very well handicapped and strong, and the strength of stamina got stuck in. It was just one of them years. He went and won the classic at Warwick before he went on to win the Grand National. So everything fell right that year. Derek Fox gave him an amazing ride.
Okay, now you've widened your scope a bit, because you've had a Royal Ascot winner.
Yeah.
Now the flat is where the potential massive money is for an owner. I mean, are you going more that way, and do you retain an interest of any of those horses that might go on to make fortunes breeding, etc.?
No. And I'm not going that way, because I got to a point where I was spreading myself too thin, and I had to concentrate. I was trying to do all the flat sales and all the national hunts, and it was nearly physically impossible to do all the Ireland trips then as well. I was just never at home. I might as well just had a caravan. Do you know what I mean? So I'm not around enough flat people to make it worthwhile. I like buying a few flat horses. I probably buy 10, 12 flat horses a year. But my main business, 95% of my business, is all national hunt.
All right, Tom, we took this in the end of the last part. We talked about the Royal Ascot winner and you sort of not going into the flat in a big way. But as far away as you can get from Royal Ascot in horse racing is point to pointing. I've seen you at loads of point to points in all sorts of hideous weather and stuff. I mean, is your participation in pointing mainly for business, or is it the love of the sport as well?
It's a combination of everything. Love of the sport, definitely. I just love racing, and I do like point to point. It was probably Jerry Supple, really, that got me rolling with the pointers. And the yard here itself, it blends to keeping a member of staff quite happy as well, having three or four to ride out every day and then doing the tidying up and the lawns and whatnot. So it worked well, and I enjoy having four or five pointers around, because I like competition, and the yard can get paid for it. If I get it right and buy the right horse, the yard gets paid for the year. So that tidies that off, and I just like winning. It doesn't matter where it is, I like winning.
Now, it's interesting because at the time of recording this, Fresh Perspective was a winner in your colours at the weekend, but trained by Will Biddick.
Yeah.
So why have you suddenly got Will Biddick training?
Well, I had a member of staff, a very, very good one, Lee Stevens, who moved on to Greener Pastures in last July. And I get away a lot to do all my point-to-pointing and whatnot in Ireland and France and whatnot. And I didn't have a good enough staff member, and that horse was standing me a lot of money. I wanted it done professionally and properly, and so it was as easy to send it to Will. He does 20 of Paul's, and he just mushed him in along them, and sure kept me updated, and I went and seen him plenty, and he's a smart horse.
So you've not turned in training yourself?
Oh God, no. And I'd say, well, Lee's actually coming back to work for me next Monday. He's decided he wants his old job back. So I'll probably get three or four more back, and we may have a runner or two before the season's out.
Now, I don't want to go back over old Greg. You talked about this a bit in the previous part, but I'm interested in, because there has been talk about the state of point-to-point in the UK, a bit uncompetitive last season and not enough horses and stuff. I mean, well, how do you feel about the state of the sport at the moment?
I think the sport's fine. You probably want more people for more competition, but there's a group of young guys, Tom Weston, Charlie and Fran Post, Tom Lacey, who else is there? There's fight Will Biddock and Chris Barber, and Tom and Gina Ellis. There are seven people that are as good a little trainers in the country. So you keep that young, kind of vibrant stock going on, and they're bringing horses through. That's all you need. And it's always been a fruitful place. People love racing, so I'd say it'll be fine. I do find I can cherry pick an Irish horse out of Ireland for modest money, and it'll be a certainty over here. So the level of competition is a far lower grade here, unless you bump into a fresh perspective. If you bump into him, it's different.
So do you think that if you're in charge of point to pointing, do you think you could change it to the extent that it could compete with Irish in sort of 10, 20 years' time?
It could, yes, definitely, in time. Because people that get more confident, they're only going against four-year-olds. They have to change that. They literally have to change that. I know they do a few four- and five-year-olds, which is fine if that's as far as they want to go. Keep a six-year-old away from a four- or five-year-old. You know what I mean? If you want to show him off to be classy, you can't have a six-year-old maiden near him getting 21 pounds off him. It just won't work.
So there could be a time that you're buying a horse for 100 grand out of a Chipley Park maiden?
Well, I bought a filly from Chatterley Corbett for 175 grand before Christmas. So I do. The first three home are four-year-olds. So I don't. They can still run. And I've no problem giving money for an English pint of pinter, but they'll never make as much as an Irish because the confidence isn't there.
Okay, now before you actually go to buy your horse, wherever you buy it from,
yeah,
is there a pedigree or a bloodline that you're looking for? Is there anything that you whittle it down? You say you've condensed everything that you do. So where does it start with you for buying a horse?
So the catalogue will come out 3 weeks before. 4 weeks before a sale, especially the big store sales. I'll whittle that catalogue down, but I'll definitely see three quarters of that catalogue. So if there's two, there could be 400 horses there, I'll see 300 of them over a 2 or 3 day period. And I'll condense that down to 35, 40, and then I'll end up buying 7 or 8. And that's how that basically works. And the 25% I haven't seen, my team will see them to make sure I haven't missed a little gem that hadn't got the right pedigree, didn't have the right stallion. So we realistically see every horse at the sale. I might, with my eyes, but the ones I need to see that tick the boxes, because thankfully we've got to a position where we can buy the best store now, or that's perceived the best store, with the daddy, the dam line, the physical, everything. Everything's ticked, and we can buy them. So I don't need to take a chance on a store. I can buy one that has less pedigree after it's won because it's proven it's better than it's outrunning its pedigree. But at store sale, I don't need to buy him.
Okay, now recently, well, a couple of years ago, the bloodstock industry came in for a bit of scrutiny and a bit of stick.
Yeah.
Do you feel that some of that has been justified? Any of that been justified?
In my time, I don't think so. The scenarios that were put in the papers when it all came up were from 20 years ago. Well, grand, everything's evolved from 20 years ago. Gambles on racetracks 20 years ago when there was one camera were pure shenanigans, and you know that better than anyone, so you can't get away with that now, and the industry's a lot tighter now, a lot tighter. So, personally, I've not seen it. Yes, there have been rumours of years ago, but sure, who cares? Let's move on. Tomorrow's another day. Look forward, don't look back.
Okay, so when you, just for people that don't know, and I don't really know myself, what percentage of horses that you buy are bought to order with funds in your back pocket from owners, and what percentage do you take a gamble on, bring back here and hope to sell on for a profit?
50-50. I would have my business if I waited for the phone call to ring now tomorrow. So I bought 160 horses last year. You can guarantee if I waited for the phone to ring, it would have been 80. If I see a horse I like, I buy him. I don't wait for someone else to buy him. It would break my heart to see a horse I found having someone else beaten me to it. It hasn't happened in 5 years. It probably happened a couple of times before that, but my character wouldn't allow that happen. If I see a horse I want, I do the deal, I shake the man's hand, and I go away. And between me shaking a man's hand, I've never let someone down. So when I shake their hand, they know it's done. Even if I get them sold to an owner in the meantime, if it happens, I'll pay for them when they come here. And they know they'll never let me down then. They'll never renege on the deal because I've never let them down. So that's how I run my business. If I shake a man's hand, I look him in the eye, the deal is done.
Okay, now I spent a lot of my sort of career in inverted commas writing about, sort of talking about big gamblers in the betting ring, all that sort of thing. I mean, but you guys in the bloodstock industry are actually the biggest gamblers in the whole industry. Would you not call it gambling?
It would only be when someone like yourself says it, and I think he's actually right, you know. I mean, I would think nothing of, at this stage now, thankfully it's got to that, I would think nothing of, if I found a horse and he was, after winning his final point, he was 200 grand, I'd say, yeah, I'll have him. And get it done in the meantime. But it is massive gamble, and I've had catastrophic errors. Horses come and they get hurt, or in the meantime, the farm has worked out horrific, or, you know, I made a boo-boo, and thankfully that's less than the good moves, but it happens. You know, I remember, I think I was about 180 grand out with three horses one season 10 years ago. It nearly wiped me out, it did. Do you know what I mean? But you dust yourself down, you keep looking. The one thing about my four-legged friends, you never know what's coming tomorrow, you never know what's coming next week. It's the greatest sport in the world. Honestly, I used to think, oh shit, where's the next one coming from? By God, they're coming in abundance at speed. I love it, I do. You just never know. Native River, Arkle, Sprinter Sacra, he's out there and he's around the corner. And that's how I look at it every day of my life.
Now we're sat in a absolutely wonderful property here, so you've obviously done very well. But you're walking along the walking down to the paddock at the point to point, and you see one of yours, it's a 2-to-1 chance, and you make it odds on. Would you still get a few quid out and have it on?
Yeah, it was funny. We went to what's the name of the little track where you're standing on the hill? It's a little bowl underneath you. Trebidannon, is it? Yeah, Trebidannon. And I had the last but one, a lovely horse called The Last But One. And he was after getting beat a few times. What was the mare or the good horse Joe Buck used to ride for Les Jefford? The black one used to win bloody loads of races on it, but it had beaten us twice. But I'd gone away and handicapped mine on the rules and fired its pallet. They put him up in a 3-runner race. Master Baker, that's what it was, Master Baker. They put him up at 10-to-1 in a 3-runner race, and I had his pallet fired. I thought, he's a certainty. Your man's beating him 2 lengths when he needed his pallet fired. And I'll never forget, I had 500 quid on him, 10-to-1 with 3 bookies, obviously between them, the 500 quid. And that was a sweet little touch. And went back up to collect funds off one of them. He says, I thought that horse was gone. I said, well, look what thought done.
What's been your biggest winner and loser? Not betting with the bookies, but with your purchases.
Biggest winner. Oh, good shout. Biggest winner. Well, it wasn't my winner, but Native River would be one of the biggest winners, to be fair. Or On Violin, Brave Man's Game. Them three would be pretty spectacular wins. But Native River, because he costs less than 6 figures and he's won more than any of them. So you'd have to say that. Biggest loser. Bought a horse one day called Trevelyan's Corn. I'd run faster than him and he cost 400 grand. I would run faster than him. Now, things transpired against him in the end. But also, it was just one of them catastrophic errors. And every time he ran, I looked at him and go, oh, please, horse, just, we'll have to retire you. Stop this. I can't take it anymore. So, like I said, I'm a big boy. I know I take the rough with the smooth and the good days and the bad days.
Now, a good day, I imagine, was when you bought your local pub.
Yeah, well, that was a funny one. I used to go up, it's only a mile up the road, and I used to go up there every Sunday afternoon after all the pointing was finished and racing was finished and have a few drinks with the lads and play pool. I love playing pool. And the bloody thing closed down last July, and I was thinking, that's a bit dull now, so I'll have to find somewhere else. But in the end, I couldn't find anywhere else, didn't want to go anywhere else. And 2 or 3 months later, I said, probably have a go at buying this. And we bought it. And John Coward, who runs the two best pubs in the area, the Bearham with Liscombe and the Martlet in Lankford Budville, I got a meeting with him. We didn't know each other. And after listening to him talk about what he does in his pubs and how he runs them, and unknowns to me, he was asking a friend that I was with what was happening with the pub. And what he said he'd do to that and what he could do with it, I went, wow, this man doesn't even know it, but he's going to run this for me. So I bought it.
What's it called? We need to advertise this.
It's called the Royal Oak in Hill Common. Yeah, it's like the racing pub of the area now. So most of the trainers call in on their way home from racing at Exeter or Newton Abbott or places Taunton even. So it's been frequented by plenty of trainers now lately. The food's amazing and the crack is good. And we gutted it and started again, so it had a proper makeover in 10 weeks. And we got it open on the 15th of December. And I was at Cheltenham Sales on the 15th of December. What a day to pick to open it. But all of the Irish guys came, got a minibus and came down for the opening. Gordon Elliott, Eddie O'Leary, they were all there, every one of them. We had a great night.
So on a normal day, if a trainer comes back from Exeter races and pops into the pub, do they see a smiling Tom Malone pulling the pint behind the bar?
No, definitely not. No, my job, look, I've leased it to John. John's in charge of all that. I don't get in the way of it. He keeps me well informed, which is very kind of him, but it's down to him. It's nothing. The running of it's nothing to do with me, thank God, because if it was, I wouldn't own it. Because my job is what I need to concentrate on, not pulling a pint.
Right, and then finally, Tom, you're still a young man. Yeah. We started the interview talking about you sourcing horses that have won some of the biggest races in national hunt racing. You've already sourced a Group 1 winner at Royal Ascot. You're a bit young to have peaked, so have you got a target ambition?
There's no peaking here. Another 10 Gold Cup winners, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. And I want a champion hurley winner. I don't seem to buy that type of horse. I've looked at that strongly to see why. Most of the animals are buying are kind of staying chasers, so I'm going to have to tweak a small bit because I want a champion hurdle winner, but I want another 10 Gold Cups is the plan.
And what price do you make yourself?
Probably 100-1. But I'd back myself.
Nobody would lay you at that
price. No, they wouldn't.
Anyway, but Tom Malone, thank you very much.
Thank you.